Unscripted. Unscripted with Niamh O'Connor. A Go Loud original podcast.
My name's Niamh O'Connor and this is my podcast, Unscripted, a Go Loud original. You may have seen me knocking around TikTok and Instagram, but if you don't know me, this podcast is the best way to get to know anything and everything there is to know about me. When I was thinking of an idea for my podcast, I wanted it to be something really authentic. I wanted it to be something that reflected me, and I thought Unscripted was just that. I think everybody knows that's one thing that I definitely am. We all know I've had my fair shares of ups and downs, so whether it's love life or just a daily dilemma, I'm going to be here to help. I've probably gone through it. Each week, I'll be covering a new topic and asking you guys to send in your dilemmas for me to answer right here in the studio. There'll be new episodes available every Wednesday on the Go Loud app or wherever you guys get your podcasts. Hello guys and welcome back to episode 20 of Unscripted. So because we had such a good response in regards to the episode that I done about my diagnosis of autism, we decided that today we would love to bring in a psychologist, a professional, to answer a lot of the questions that you guys have. One thing that I find is that I get so many questions and honestly, I just don't know the answers to a lot of them. I'm still learning to understand myself and I only got diagnosed last March, so it's very, very recent and I'm not a professional, so I don't know the right answer to everything. So I thought it might be really good for our listeners and maybe the ones that are neurodivergent themselves or are questioning if they're neurodivergent to have this episode to listen to, or that I can refer them to this episode if I get any messages myself. So today we have Sarah Flynn, who is a chartered child and educational psychologist. She's been working in both private and public sector for over 15 years. She's the CEO and lead psychologist at Sycamore Psychology, and she holds 3 degrees in science and psychology, including a doctorate in educational and child psychology. That is really, really impressive. She's a parent and has merged her love and experience of psychology with that of being a parent, which allows her to take theory and apply it in a realistic way, allowing for maximum impact within a limited time. She's also hosting a group for 18 to 21-year-old females with autism on February the 4th that will cover key areas for young women to enable and empower them to plan for their future. We're going to get a little bit more into that as the episode goes on. So if that's something that you think you would be interested in, make sure you listen out for that. Now, let's get into the episode, guys. Today, we are joined by Dr. Sarah Flynn, who is a child and educational psychologist and the CEO of Sycamore Psychology. Thank you so much for coming in today, Sarah. We really appreciate it. I think a lot of our listeners will really appreciate having you here. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks very much, Niamh, for having me on here. So I am, I'm a single mother that's based here in Dublin, and I have been working in the area of psychology for the last 15 years. I started out, actually the first service that I worked in was an autism specific service down in Cork, a superb service, the South Lee Autism Service Team was the name of them. And then I started working for the Department of Education with a group called NEPS. I don't know, have you come across them ever?
No.
So it's the National Educational Psychological Service.
Okay.
So it's kind of like the psychological part of the Department of Education.
Okay.
So I worked for them for about 7 years, and then during COVID, I decided to take the plunge and I went private, and I've been working privately since.
Okay, amazing.
And I've been working primarily in the area of autism and like diagnosing autism all that time.
Okay. It's amazing that you're a CEO and a single mother. I think that's breaking down barriers, and I think that's really, really amazing. It's such an achievement. What actually made you get into psychology? What sparked your interest?
Well, I've always been really interested in people, and kind of when I was younger myself, wouldn't always have been able to understand them in the best ways. Mm-hmm. So as I was getting older, I was trying to kind of figure out what's the best way to kind of navigate my own life.
Yeah.
And psychology was one that came up trumps quite a bit. You know, everyone likes talking about psychology. Yeah. I get to learn about myself. I get to learn about others.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of the main reasons.
Yeah, I would find, I'd be very interested in, like, I know this is off topic now, but I love watching, like, you know, like true crime shows and like thinking about the psychology behind it. I think psychology is super interesting. It's something that I would have a lot of interest in. Now, I don't think I'd ever be able to do it myself. I think I'd start like analysing myself too much. But
well, that's what actually a lot of people study psychology for, that
reason.
Oh,
really? To analyse themselves?
Well, not, they kind of, they go into it kind of with one set thinking, you know, I want to learn about psychology, and then they learn a lot about themselves. But then they never actually end up practicing as psychologists. Yeah. So it's really, that's kind of what the premise is for them.
Yeah, that sparks the interest in it, kind of. And can you tell me a little bit about your experience working with neurodivergent clients? I know you said that's primarily what you work with. How do you find that?
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I've been working with autism. I know I've been working in the diagnostic piece for the last 4 years, but I've essentially been working with autism all my psychology career. And every person that I work with, I learn something new because the presentation is just so broad. And I suppose my experience is that there are a group of people who are very misunderstood. And I work primarily with kind of the system around the child. So I work with the parents, and then I work with the school. And then depending on the capacity of the young person, generally, if they're kind of 16 or above, I'll often help them understand a little bit about their presentation as well.
Okay.
But it's very much like it's a family diagnosis, which I'm sure you're aware of, because it when you have a child that you it doesn't follow the typical trajectory.
Yeah.
And that's, as a parent, what you're waiting for and what you're looking at.
Yeah.
You know, it makes it really challenging.
Yeah.
And so therefore, the parent is trying to parent in one way and the young person is trying to respond as best they possibly can.
Yeah.
But it can get very tricky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the middle of it all.
Yeah. I feel like that was a lot. When you're saying that, it just reminds me of my childhood. I feel like I was probably seen a lot as kind of rebellious, and like I would have been like the behavioural issue child. But looking back now, I'm like, I don't think I was rebellious. I don't think I had behavioural issues. I think I was just responding in the way that I thought was appropriate to respond, but obviously it wasn't to other people.
Which is the nuts and bolts of what autism is.
Yeah,
it's like it's a social and communication difference. People are, they're understanding and processing social information in a different way than neurotypicals are. And then they're responding as best that they possibly can to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you tailor your therapeutic approach to neurodivergent people?
Well, I think the most important place to start, and for anybody who's thinking about engaging with therapy, if they do have a diagnosis of autism or they think that they might be, they should be looking for a neurodivergent aware therapist. It's like, it's one of the key things, because a lot of what I would call psychoeducation is needed. So people need to be educated and helped to understand what are the different areas of human behavior that are impacted by autism.
Yeah.
And when you start there and you're helping people to understand, for example, the majority of individuals on the spectrum are literal thinkers.
Yeah.
Or they're quite black and white. When you start there, then you can see that they don't understand nuance. If they're in a situation where somebody said something and they picked it up inaccurately, you know, it helps them to understand why they're behaving in the ways they're behaving. So starting from a place of education is really, really key. And then I very much take a humanistic approach, which basically considers the whole person and the uniqueness of each individual. So because there are so many different things that are impacting on an autistic person's ability to function in day-to-day life, it's not just about their mind or how they're seeing things. It's also about their body. It's also about their perception of events that happen to them. So, for example, autistic people would have a higher propensity for experiencing trauma because they're not experiencing or understanding banter, for example. So they can take things much more personally. So there, I feel that there's a lot more to consider with a neurodivergent client, and they really need to take a lot of time to build relationship with the person that they're working with. You know, they're not going to take a deep dive and start saying everything that's ever happened to them in one sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting you say that, because I was in therapy, God, for basically years and years and years. But I'd always go in and I'd never like, I don't know, I felt like it would never click with me. Like when I was younger, before I was diagnosed, I felt like it would never click with me. And you know what? I'd nearly end up kind of going in and just telling them what they wanted to hear so that I could get out of the therapy, and it worked.
You have no idea how often people say that.
Yeah. Every time it worked, the therapist would come out to my dad and be like, she's so much better. And I'd be sitting there like, no, I'm not. I'm not better. But it never really clicked with me. So it's interesting that you say that that's kind of an experience that people have.
But also like, so psychotherapy, so lots of people hear about psychotherapists. Yeah. So psychotherapy is very much focuses on the client speaking and the therapist kind of helping them navigate that, as opposed to the psychotherapist asking specific questions or offering specific information. However, again, kind of coming back to that idea, I really think that neurodivergent people, they need that information. They need to be given and helped to understand, okay, well, this is maybe what's happening for you, or this would be quite a common characteristics of people on the spectrum.
Yeah. Okay, that's a really interesting. I feel like my brain is like ticking as you're speaking as well, like relating it back to myself. What is the best approach to take when looking for an assessment in neurodivergency, in your opinion?
Okay, so unfortunately, the public system does not provide adult diagnosis in Ireland. And I know from listening to your own podcast that there was a lot of pushback to yourself, that people were kind of commenting on going private. But you're not really left with any other option. You know, there's a lot of questions can be bandied around, like, you know, well, why do you even need to go and get a diagnosis?
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you've got. Oh, yeah. In my opinion, people need it to be identified for them. They need to be kind of given that stamp of, okay, actually, this is what's happening for you.
Yeah.
So many, particularly females, they are in two camps.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're thinking about themselves, but this is really neurotypical behaviour. Okay, I must be neurotypical.
Yeah.
And then they'll do something else. They go, but this is definitely not neurotypical. This is definitely not something else.
Yeah.
And so they're in limbo. Yeah. One foot in, one foot out. One foot in, one foot out. And that not knowing really, really impacts on the identity of the self. And if we don't know who we are, we can't self-actualize. We can't become the people that we want to become, because there's always something in the back of our head questioning.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's just one thing that I've had as well, and that kind of relates to that, is ever since I got my diagnosis, I've had people say, like, it's so ignorant. So this is not my words, but I've had people be like, oh, well, now you act way more autistic. And it's like, number one, that's ridiculous. But number two, I think it's probably an element of, like, people are more comfortable to just fully be themselves once they kind of understand. Whereas before, I feel like there was so many things with me looking back that I would have hid all of the time. I would have masked. Like, now that I look back, I was just, and that's why I was so erratic all the time, because I didn't know who I was, and I was constantly fighting a battle in myself. So I feel like people saying that, it's like, I think it's more that people feel more comfortable to just be themselves once they have the, okay, this is what you are, and you know that's what you are.
I think you're absolutely bang on the button that when you are told by a professional, yes, this is what's happening for you, then as time is going on and you're what we call like integrating this knowledge. So you have this new knowledge now, and the next thing, I'm in a situation where I've just taken somebody up really literal. And before, I would have been like, I've just taken them up literally, but I don't really know. Should I say something? Or will I just laugh along? I'll just laugh along. Yeah. Not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
Whereas when you know, now you can go, excuse me, actually, I'm really quite literal.
Yeah.
So I don't really get what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it not only empowers you, but it actually empowers the relationship that you're in to move forward.
I think as well, it's since I've got diagnosed, I feel like before my social battery was so low. Now it's still low, but before it was so low, because I was always, exactly what you just said there, there would be so many occasions, a lot of my friends are very funny, very witty, very like, you know, quick jokes, and I'd be sitting there like just not getting it, and I'd just laugh along, like. And now I feel, it's interesting, because only last week on the podcast, remember, we had Daniel and Dylan on, and there was like, they were all laughing about something, and I was like, I don't get it, I feel like I'm not in the joke. So I think, yeah, it's definitely, you get a lot more confidence to I don't know, advocate for yourself, I suppose.
100%.
Yeah.
But there's also, like, you know, physiologically what's actually happening in the body. So when you're in that situation where everyone's laughing, you're like, oh God, should I laugh?
Yeah.
Your body goes into like a freeze response,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that freeze response causes, it's like essentially it's draining on the body,
mm-hmm.
okay? And you're going to need time to come back down from that. So if you are constantly going in and out, in and out, in and out of relaxed state, freeze state, relaxed state, freeze state, that is actually one of the things that is really, really draining on the body.
Okay.
Like, that's only part of it, as you're well aware. There's
yeah.
also, you know, somebody new comes into the room, everyone's saying hello, now you're expected to get involved into this
yeah.
new social interaction that maybe you don't want to have anything to do with it mm-hmm. all. So there's all these different what we call social demands that are constantly drawing on the person.
Yeah.
And again, when you have the identification, first of all, I think one of the key things for people is to plan out their time. If they know that they have a short social battery, then they shouldn't be like putting too many things into their day.
Yeah.
Do you do that?
Yeah. 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 I used to. Do you know, before, this is one of the things that actually came up in my assessment, but before I would have, you know, tried to join in on everything, done everything, made 7 different plans in a day. Now I'm like, I will do something with my friends once a week. And like people look, even on social media, people to be calling me a loner and all. And I'm like, but I'm happy like that. That's what I want. And it's only really since I got the assessment that I even have the confidence to be like, no, I don't want to join in on everything. I want to do like my thing, whether that's once or twice a week, I'll see my friends. So yeah, I think definitely 100% that I can reflect back on that.
And like if there's, let's say for example, there's a big night out.
Yeah.
Or there's some kind of big event that you're the centre of.
Yeah.
It's really important to be planning time after that to decompress. You know, having lists of things that you really enjoy doing, like we
yeah.
call them glimmers.
Mm-hmm.
Glimmers are things that give you that positive boost.
Yeah.
And so if it is having a bath, listening to a podcast, going for a walk, spending time with your dog, whatever it is, it's actually good. Like the autistic mind loves lists.
Mm-hmm.
So have the list there, because if you are overwhelmed, your brain capacity and your executive functioning isn't working to help you go, what's the thing that I need to do now to help me decompress?
Mm-hmm.
I have a list. Go to your list, see something you like, and off you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you keep lists?
So I'm more of, how do I explain me? The lists, I never was a big list person, but I feel like I have lists in my head in my own ways. Like I'm not somebody that writes down lists. I say that, but I have a load of lists in my notes app on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I am.
That's my favourite part of the
yeah,
phone.
Yeah, yeah. I'm more, do you know what? I'm more, I feel like with me, there's some things that I'm like, exactly what you were saying earlier. When people say, oh yeah, like, do you take lists? I'm like, no. So I mustn't be autistic. But then I can reflect it back to, okay, I don't make lists, but I do this instead. I feel like I have my own version of lists. I'm actually not the most organized person. Like I'm organized in my head, but to other people, they're like, you are a mess. But my boyfriend loves lists. I mean, he has a list for everything, every single thing, no sap full of lists. He has a list of like, where we've gone on holidays, where we want to, it's completely ridiculous. But yeah, I'm not that bad, but I don't know.
It's not a bad thing.
No, it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's not. See, I have to correct myself a lot of the time when I'm speaking, because do you know another thing I often say is like, I'm so odd. And then I'm like, no, I'm not odd. I'm not odd. But yeah, I'm trying to think, am I? Let me look at my notes app on my phone and see if I'm a list person.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. Well, actually, yeah, maybe I am. Me saying I'm not a list.
That's a really nice looking list.
I think I'm still in denial a little bit about it.
Well, not necessarily. It mightn't be denial. It's just because, you know, you're going along your life.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, about the integration, essentially what happens is you get the information and then you're starting to reframe your past experiences.
Yes.
Or you're reframing, oh yeah, actually, I am a list taker.
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm learning so much as well, because like it's still very recent for me. It was last March, I think, that I got diagnosed. So it's still very recent, and it's still, I don't even still know a lot of stuff about myself. So I'm still learning what works with me, what doesn't, because I feel like my whole life, like autism was never something that I even thought about. It was never something that even came into my head. My whole life I was kind of, I believed that it could be something like BPD or bipolar or one of these. And then I actually went for an assessment. Well, I went for the first stage of an assessment for bipolar, and they were like, no, you don't have this. And then I felt lost. Like, I was like, okay, what's wrong with me? Because I always knew there was something. It's, there's nothing wrong. Again, that's the same talk, but there's nothing wrong. But I always knew there was something different. And yeah, I suppose I could never put my finger on it. And then when I got that diagnosis, it was like, wow, okay, this never came into my head. It was never something, you know, bar in the last couple of years when I was younger, I never would have thought it. So I feel like I'm still learning so much, and I still have so much to learn about myself.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up that piece there about thinking that you were bipolar.
Yeah.
Because it's really important for your listeners to, yeah, for us to talk about this.
Yeah.
Because a very, very high number of parents who come to me say, I'll say to them, has your young person asked you or said anything about that they think they might be autistic? And they, yeah, often say, no, they've checked out their characteristics and they think that they're bipolar.
Yeah.
It's so, so frequent.
Mm-hmm. With me, it's, I think why I thought that, I'm very emotional. I have no, even more so than like, you know, the characteristics like taking lists. And I'm actually more, it's complete emotion. I have no emotional regulation at all. Like I can go from having the happiest day of my life to the end of the world, the worst day of my life, in 2 seconds.
And then back again.
And back again, and back again, and back again, just over and over and over again. And it's exhausting. Like, it's actually exhausting. And I can get so emotional about things that just other people don't see as a big deal, which then can lead to misunderstanding with other people. So I feel like because it was that emotional thing, that's why I kind of was like, it must be bipolar, it must be BPD. I feel like that side of autism isn't kind of spoken about as much as, okay, I like taking lists and I'm a literal thinker. People don't think as much about the emotional side of it, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when younger children come for the diagnostic process, a lot of them would have challenges with emotional regulation.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, do you know what I mean by the bell curve?
No.
Okay, I want to show you something.
Yeah, show me.
Never seen this before?
No.
Okay. So,
I don't think so. Do you want to show it to the camera there and I'll put it on?
Okay, okay, so this is called the bell curve, right? And so we use the bell curve generally when we are like, for example, when you were in school and you would have been given standardized tests, all the class are given the test at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the schools in Ireland would be doing the same test. So then they have all these scores. And then what we do is we can put the results into this bell curve to see what is the average person, the score the average person is getting.
Okay.
Yeah? So this big bump here in the middle, this is called the average range, okay? So I think this, so we use this for test scores, understanding test scores, but I think it's really, really useful for understanding neurodivergent behaviour as well, okay? Because let's say, for example, with emotional regulation, okay? So the majority of the population, okay, your neurotypicals, they express their emotions in more or less the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah? And they understand other people's emotions in more or less the same way.
Yeah.
But down here we've the tails.
Right.
Yeah? Okay? So less people are getting these scores here.
Yeah.
So neurodivergence, autistic people, they tend to under-experience the emotion or over-experience the emotion.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So like emotions are actually, they're learned in society. So for example, if you go to Japan, the way that Japanese people respond emotionally is very different than the way Irish people is.
Okay.
And we learn that culturally.
Mm-hmm.
But because the way that the autistic mind works, particularly when they're quite young, they're not really paying the same level of attention to what's going on around them. So they're not picking up what everybody else is doing in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, when it comes to having to then express the emotions, they're expressing it in a different way.
Okay.
But they're also much more, like this idea that autistic people don't have empathy is absolutely rubbish.
Oh, it's so wrong. I always say that. I'm like over empathetic. I'm like this is just such a, sorry, off topic, but like, do you remember the Eurovision when Ireland gave Israel 10 points? I was screaming my head off, crying, like literally end of the world. And everyone online was like, what is wrong with you? Like, this is not that deep. I was like, it is. Like, I feel like it's people have such a wrong idea because I feel like I have over empathy and that leads me into trouble so much because I trust everyone. Yeah. So,
well, you can think of it in this way instead, right? That there's two different types of empathy.
Yeah.
Okay. One is what we call like a cognitive empathy.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other one is like a body empathy.
Yeah.
So your cognitive empathy is perspective taking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, most certainly this is an area that is challenging for autistic people.
Yeah.
But in my experience, I find that the body empathy,
yeah,
it's like your aura, you know what I mean by your aura?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like your aura is like way outside your body.
Yeah.
So you're actually processing all sorts of different emotions that are happening all around you all the time. So a lot of the time it's not even yours.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, energetic work is an area that I think is really, really important for autistic people, where they're learning more about their own bodies, their own energetic boundaries, and being able to put those in place when they're going out into different types of situations.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. And I'm really glad you said that, because that is one, I hate that perception of autism or neurodivergency, that there is a lack of empathy. I feel like as well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like maybe it can seem... like, I know sometimes if somebody is crying to me, and I remember there was times where people were crying to me and telling me like their dog died or whatever, and I was just like, oh, I'm really sorry. So that can seem like a lack of empathy, but it's actually not. Like, I am empathetic, but sometimes I struggle to actually put that across in my body language, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So you might be looking at me and I might look stone-faced, but I'm not. I do care.
So you're feeling it on the inside, but it's not necessarily communicated on the outside.
Exactly.
Again, one of the classic aspects of autism.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then other times, like that time on TikTok, I can be screaming, crying, and everyone can see it. That's what I mean when I say I'm an emotional roller coaster. That's why I thought that I had BPD or bipolar, because the emotions all over the place. Still to this day, I feel like it's something that I don't know if I'll ever get a handle on it. Hopefully I do.
So do you engage in any kind of meditative practices?
No,
like that?
No.
That's where the magic is.
I'm actually really, this is really bad. I really struggle now. I think this could be a lot of things. Like, I have a lot of trauma that has happened to me in my life, but I really struggle with any sort of like going into my own mind. Like, even when I go to sleep, I listen. I have AirPods in my ears listening to a podcast to go to sleep. I just hate being in my own head. But that's something that I definitely really, really need to work on, because when I was younger, I wasn't like that at all. I used to love reading. Like, I read like a million books a year constantly all the time, and I loved being in my own head. So maybe that's like even less to do with neurodivergency and more to do with trauma, that I just hate that kind of space. But my friend has ADHD and he meditates all the time. Mm. And he says it really helps him. Like, when he's feeling super emotional, he starts meditating and it makes him feel better. So I definitely need to give it a go.
Yeah, I mean... essentially, what you're describing is you're running away from your own experience.
Yeah.
And but it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
It's always sitting there waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
So by often engaging in meditative practices, what we do is we learn to sit with that. We learn to sit with those really, really, really challenging feelings.
Yeah.
And then what happens actually when you sit with them is they actually... you just pass through them.
Yeah.
And they don't have that massive control over that they used to have.
Yeah.
But... you know, meditation, a lot of people think that it's, you know, well, you need to sit down and think about nothing.
Yeah.
Which theoretically it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the best way to do it, particularly for neurodivergent people, is to go to a class and learn a set of steps.
Okay.
So like your list.
Yeah.
It's a logical set of steps. If I do this and then I do this. So the brain is actually active.
Mm-hmm.
You're not trying to tell the brain to do nothing.
Yeah.
You're actually giving it something to do.
Yeah.
So it has a focus, and then... while it's doing that, essentially the rest of the brain can just relax. And calm down.
Okay, that's something that I definitely need to do, because the amount, I feel like I've got a lot, since I've got diagnosed, I feel like I'm a lot better because I'm less kind of pushing against like my own thoughts and feelings, but I still definitely struggle with emotional, like Lauren sees it in here all the time. I'll be talking on the podcast, next thing you know, I'm screaming, crying over nothing. So I think that could be really helpful for me.
And so like an awful lot of autistic people as well experience a really, really strong disconnect between the mind and the body.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the emotions are experienced as anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, there's no subtlety in knowing the difference.
Yeah.
So helping them to come back in and connect the body and the mind is really, really important for emotional regulation. And the key way to do that is deep breathing.
Okay. Perfect.
100%. Every time.
Yeah, I remember when I was younger, I used to, my dad would be like, Niamh, deep breaths. I'd be so upset screaming. My dad would be like, breathe in and out. But it did work. It did work. It's, see, I feel like these are all things that we maybe don't even think when we're older, that these, because I don't know. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm definitely going to come away from this episode with a lot of new information about myself or new ways to cope with things.
Yeah. Self-care plans are really important as well. Like we were talking earlier on about the glimmers.
Yeah.
Those little things that help you kind of recharge.
Mm-hmm.
But also things like, do I have a daily practice? Like you probably have a daily practice around, for example, makeup.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a daily practice around taking care of your inner self, your mental health.
Yeah.
You know, does that involve breathing? Does that involve meditation? Does that involve mantra work? Mm-hmm. You ever use mantras?
No.
Well, mantras are amazing.
No.
Is it okay if I ask you a personal?
No, of course. Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you have repetitive thoughts?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Are they positive?
No.
No. Okay. So what the idea behind the mantra is that you're taking that process that you're doing really well, saying the same thing over and over and over and over again, but you're replacing it with a positive thought.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. It was when I was doing my final year exams for psychology,
mm-hmm.
and I was so nervous. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so nervous, I'm just going to forget everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to use a mantra. This is actually the first time I used a mantra. So the two things that I was not feeling confident.
Yeah.
And I was not feeling competent.
Yeah.
So I was like, these are what I want to feel. So I thought about the thing that I wasn't feeling and I thought about the opposite.
Okay.
I am confident. And I am competent.
Okay.
And I had to walk to the exam hall from my house, which took about 25 minutes. And I said it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confident, I'm competent, I'm confident, I am competent. The whole way. And by the time I got there, I was walking on a cloud.
Yeah, you're feeling great.
Great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because like your mind doesn't know the difference between the lie and the truth.
Okay.
So you can lie to your own mind
mm-hmm.
and tell it things.
And then it'll believe it.
And it'll believe it.
Yeah, I suppose that's kind of like... They say, well, I know this is true because I've done it I've done it in my life before. But you know, when you wake up in a really bad mood and you just smile and you pretend that you're happy and your mind does believe that you're happy after a while. Yeah. So
the whole idea that happiness is a choice.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think we shouldn't just say that in a blanket format that it's a choice because some people are in incredibly challenging situations.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the time, life is pretty good. You know, we have a roof over our heads. We have food in our bellies. You know, life is good. We get to go out. We've got money in our pockets. So at this exact point in time, do I actually have anything to worry about?
Yeah.
It's a really good question to ask yourself.
Yeah. And I know you were saying that there's not really a public system for adults and that you kind of have to go privately. So would that be kind of the best route that you would advise people to take, or what advice would you give them if there's anybody listening that maybe does think that they may be neurodivergent and wants to look into it?
Well, I suppose because it's a very backed up system,
mm-hmm.
so even if you're going privately, there's a really long wait list.
Yeah.
And it's very expensive.
Yeah.
I think the best thing to do is start writing down the different things. Keep a list of the different things that you think constitutes a neurodivergent profile. There's a website called Embrace Autism, and they have a lot of really, really useful tools, like checklists and for identifying it in their self. So that's a really good place to start as well. Gather all your information together so that you're kind of saying to yourself, okay, look, I actually think I've got enough evidence here to say I should save the money and I should go ahead and get this done privately.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going down the private route, it's really important that you find out if the clinician is registered with either the mm-hmm. Psychological Society of Ireland, called the PSI, or the British Psychological Society, the BPS, and that the reports will be accepted by the HSE, or if it's a younger person, by the Department of Education. Unfortunately, psychology is not regulated in Ireland yet, and we have had some cases of some bogus psychologists who are taking advantage of people in these situations.
Yeah.
Even after going through the process yourself, like, you'll know that you're in such a delicate and a vulnerable state that you need the person to be able to hold that space. They're able to, you're in there and you're giving all this information about yourself. And a lot of the time, you've never verbalized it before.
Yeah.
So that needs to be really, really well held. Yeah. And so then when the information is given back to you in a report form, that it's written in a what we call a neuroaffirmative way. And that means that, like, for example, the term ASD is never used. And for all your listeners, if you use it, please stop using it. It has the D and it stands for a disorder. Mm-hmm. Autistic people are not disordered. They have a different way of processing social information. Sorry, perfect. Can I ask it? Were you assessed by a male or a female?
Female.
Okay. Did female. You choose a female?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I chose a female. I don't know why, actually. I was given like a list kind of people that I could go with, and I just chose the female. I think I felt more connected. But yeah, it was a female. I found the assessment process very difficult. Very, very, very difficult. Like, I needed like days afterwards to recover, because just as you were saying, there was a lot of stuff that like was never, I never would have thought. And the woman that assessed me, she was nearly, there was so much coming up that it was like, it was there was so much trauma coming up because of things that maybe happened in my life that I would have never seen as like me not.
Were you kind of misinterpreting situations?
Yeah, yeah. And there was a lot of that. And there was a lot of like kind of reflection back on things. And it was very, very difficult. Like, I was, for about 5 days afterwards, I was emotional wreck. And but yeah, I found it really difficult. So I think that's another thing to maybe warn. Well, no, I don't want to scare anyone away, but it's very emotional time. And as you said, there's a lot of stuff you're verbalizing that you've never verbalized before, kind of thing. So it's heavy at times. I thought it was anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of planning, if you can, if there's like, if you have a family member or a friend who's a really good support, it's good to have them around afterwards. Sorry, if I can just ask, how long were you questioning your, like, when did you start thinking, oh, maybe I'm autistic?
So it's kind of, do you know, when I was a teenager, I thought I had ADHD. I begged to be assessed for ADHD. I was 100% convinced I had ADHD. But then that went out of my head. And as I got older, I was like, no, it's like bipolar or BPD or one of these. And then it was kind of when I got told, when I went for the first round of the assessment for bipolar, it was kind of like, okay, there has to be something. What could it be? And then my little cousin is autistic. Mm-hmm. And we've always thought that my dad could be autistic, but he's not diagnosed, but we've always thought he could be. So then it was kind of a thing of like, okay, maybe. I think, do you know what, I think growing up with my little cousin, she's 11 now, and seeing a lot of myself in her, like looking at her, and it just blows my mind. I'm like, oh my god, this is like a little mini me. And I was like, something clicked then. It was like, okay, she's autistic, so maybe I'm autistic, kind of thing. And that's, I think that's what really made me be like, okay, especially because she is not, I know this is kind of part of the next question, but she is not like somebody that is terrified of social interaction. She's actually loud and bubbly and kind of a bit of a leader in her friend group, you know what I mean? She's not what you would maybe typically, stereotypically think of when you think of autism. But it's, again, like her emotions, and she masks quite a lot. So I think seeing that, I was like, okay, maybe I am. Because I think maybe I had always had a very stereotypical view of what autism was before.
Yeah, and the majority of people do.
Yeah.
And like, just don't want to just zone in there on something that you've said.
Yeah.
Kind of when you're thinking about specifically the social presentation of a person, okay? So this idea that autistic people, they're loners, or that they, you know, they're walking around the yard just by themselves.
Yeah.
That can be true.
Yeah.
But you can also have people who are social butterflies.
Yeah.
So they have like really good skills of coming over here, having the chats for a couple of minutes, but don't really know how to extend it past that.
Yeah.
So then they might leave that group and go over to another group.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you've got other people who are excessive talkers.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
within the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a lot of the time how I conceptualize autism. It's not that there's just this one spectrum, but like all the different areas of human behavior that autism impacts has its own spectrum.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you're trying to figure out somebody's specific profile, you figure out, okay, well, their understanding of language is here and their ability to express language is here. But their ability to express emotional language is different to that again. So yeah. It's all completely different for each person. And that's why it's so broad.
Yeah, yeah.
When you had that that first part of the BPT assessment completed, what age were you?
Oh, maybe roughly 19, I want to say. Maybe okay. 19, 20.
Yeah, so you were 7 years questioning.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I actually think that's, particularly for adults, I think that's quite typical.
Yeah.
That it takes a long time to kind of assimilate what you're thinking and having to kind of draw on different threads from your own experience.
Yeah.
Before you're ready to actually
do it.
Do it, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's okay to give yourself that time. It's really important.
Yeah.
To honour wherever you are at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
Linking in as well with people that you trust to find out their opinion as well.
Mm-hmm.
With this type of stuff, people can be very reluctant.
Oh, very.
To give an opinion.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're a person who can be emotionally quite reactive, they're like, oh God, Jesus, if I stand on a landmine,
yeah.
I don't know how they're going to respond. But I think it's important to still ask the question if you're willing to hear the answer.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to ask these questions, be prepared for, God, they could absolutely say that I'm the worst in the world. It's
yeah.
highly unlikely.
Yeah.
But have yourself prepared so that you're able to listen to the answer.
Yeah. So I feel like this kind of connects back into what we were talking about a little bit. But so traditionally, more males have been diagnosed with autism than females. Do you want to shed some light on why that might be or what your opinion of that is?
So I think, first of all, in general, males have more externalizing behaviors
mm-hmm.
than females do. We tend to internalize stuff. So traditionally, it was easier
mm-hmm.
To see the behaviors in males.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, females were always diagnosed, but I think 2022, they were still talking about males were four times more likely to be diagnosed more than females.
Mm-hmm.
So why is this happening? So a number of different reasons. So it's considered a developmental delay, so mm-hmm. that you should technically be able to see it when somebody is quite young.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, traditionally it's picked up in primary school. It's considered a developmental delay, so you should technically be able to see it from when people are quite young. So consequently, it's often males that are identified younger. So like kind of the most common age, primary age of females that I have is generally kind of around 8 onwards.
Okay.
Yeah. So prior to that, little girls are able to, well, they look like they're playing imaginatively.
Mm-hmm.
They have the dolly there and they're rocking the dolly and they're putting the dolly to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But are they playing imaginatively with another child? A lot of the time, no.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're very much controlling the play.
Yeah.
But because we traditionally look at autism as the children can't play, young little girls are doing those things. They're like, oh, well, they couldn't possibly be autistic.
Yeah.
Or that what we spoke about earlier on about being a social butterfly.
Yeah.
Or that they might have one best friend and
yeah.
this best friend is their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that friendship breaks down, they get another
yeah, yeah, yeah.
best friend that is their entire life.
Yeah.
So the way that females present is different. The autism manifests differently on a day-to-day level when you're looking at it than it does for the majority of males.
Mm-hmm.
So thank God we're all very aware now of the language of masking.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is essentially what is happening. We spoke earlier on about like how neurotypical children, they're paying attention to what's happening around them, and neurodivergent individuals do that less so. However, girls do tend to do it more than boys when they're young. So they are aware of oh, look what that person is doing, and they're mirroring all that behaviour. Mm. So they can find that they're kind of like chameleons. In one environment, they're one person, and in another environment, they're another person. And this, again, impacts quite a lot on the sense of identity because they don't really know who they are or what really their interests are.
Yeah.
Does that ring true?
Yeah. You, as you're saying that, like, this is something that I actually questioned myself. Because I mirror people all the time, even accents. One of my friends is like a Northsider, you know, very strong Dublin accent, like Dylan. When I'm around him, that's how I speak. And people actually, see, social media can be the bane. It can be great, but it can also be the bane of all evil. Because I do it on social media. It's completely subconscious. I don't even realise I'm doing it. People would be like, oh my God, she's such a narcissist, mirroring. She has a different personality for everyone she's with. And I started to believe that about myself. I was like, oh my God, I'm a narcissist. And yeah, and then when I was doing my assessment, my psychologist said that to me about the mirror. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not a narcissist. That's me. But yeah, that really, really rings true. I feel like I even feel that about myself sometimes, that I can completely mirror the people around me and nearly sometimes take on some of their traits without even realizing that I'm doing it. It's just second nature. Even down to accents. Accents is the biggest thing with me. I'll subconsciously copy people's accents all the time.
I remember one particular client saying, this is an adult,
yeah,
saying that when I'm walking in the park, I'll start mimicking the walk, yeah, of the person in front of me. Yeah. So it's like the brain is trying to connect. It's trying to find ways to connect. But because it's not primed to do it in that typical way, it's finding alternative ways of doing it.
Okay, that's so interesting. That's really interesting. And that's, I feel like that's one of the one of the things that I really would have questioned about myself as well when I was kind of questioning, could I be autistic? I think one of the biggest things was the mirroring with me, because I think that's something that a lot of people notice about me. There's a lot of things that people don't notice about me and would be like, no, she's not autistic. She does social media and this and that. But then they'll be like, but she copies everyone. She has a different personality. And it's like, it's one of the things that I think is more obvious to people, for sure. And even the walking in the park. Now that you say that, I'm like, if me and Alex are walking together, I'll copy the way, like if his leg is like this and mine's like this, I'll switch mine. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's really interesting.
Just going back around to some of the more reasons that there's less girls,
yeah,
diagnosed. So it's really only in the last 10 years that we, like clinicians, have really become more aware of the breadth of the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to use specific diagnostic tools when you come for a diagnosis. And all of those were trialed and created on males.
Yeah.
So we're using tools on females to pick up male behaviours, essentially.
Okay.
Like, I mean, the eye contact thing would be a very, very big one. The question actually in the tool that we use, the ADOS, you know, there's not an awful lot of questioning around eye contact. And I like to think that I've devised my own way of thinking about eye contact. And I consider there's four types of eye contact. There's three neurodivergent and one neurotypical. So the first neurodivergent one is the individual who completely avoids eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is somebody who can initiate eye contact, but has more difficulty maintaining it. Yeah?
Yeah.
The third one is the stare. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then the fourth one, which is the neurotypical one, is the same as the second one, where the individual can initiate eye contact, but a neurotypical stays in the eye contact more.
Okay.
So they can initiate it, stay in it. They briefly look away,
yeah,
and then they'll go back into the eye contact. So this, again, can be a useful tool for people when they're thinking about, oh, you know, am I not on the autistic spectrum? Become aware of your own eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
When did you become aware of yours?
Very young. So when I was in school, secondary school, I was very reactive, I would say, in mm-hmm. secondary school. And I used to get pulled out of the classroom, you know, for the teachers to shout at me or whatever. And they'd be looking at me and I'd be looking over here and they'd be like, look at me when I'm talking to you. And I'd be like, I can't. It would just make me so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I always knew about myself. But again, I never really tied it back to autism because my dad is the same. So I always just said, OK, maybe I'm just like my dad. But eye contact is one I'd say that I... It switches and changes for me, though. Like, with my friends, I can be, like, totally fine, like, 100% fine. But I can also be hyper-aware. Like, I was on RTE Prime Time recently. And, you know, you're on this big, long table and Miriam O'Callaghan is this side and I'm this side. And I rang my dad before crying. I was like, Dad, people are going to think I'm lying because I'm not going to be able to look at her. And the whole time, all I was concentrated on was, look at Miriam in the eyes, look at Miriam in the eyes. So, yeah, I became aware of that actually very young, but just never tied it back to that it could possibly be a neurodivergent trait.
So you're reminding me of a young man. Well, actually, he was in his 30s. And when we were talking about the eye contact, so he was looking at me, you know, very intently. And I brought it up with him and I asked him, was he comfortable giving eye contact? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, so how much of your attention does it take to give the eye contact? So you're in a situation where you're meant to be conversing with somebody and you're free flowing, you're thinking and you're talking at the same time. But actually... he was spending, he said, about 30% of his attention just focusing on the eye contact.
Yeah.
So there's a thing called modulation. So modulation is the ability to give eye contact while you're doing another activity. Okay. And so this actually, if somebody comes into my clinic and they're able to give me eye contact and they're able to engage in it quite naturally, we give them an activity to do. It's a very mundane activity that they do every day. They have to just imitate that they're doing it.
Yeah.
Once they start doing it, eye contact is generally gone.
Yeah.
Because they can't modulate two things at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, just when you were saying like it changes for you.
Yeah.
So like often if you're with very familiar people, yes, you're very much more comfortable with eye contact.
Yeah.
But then, for example, let's say you need to talk about this podcast to them. You might find then that you're actually looking at the center.
Yeah. And I feel as well, just even I was saying, I'm kind of warming up now. I feel like my brain, even at the start of this episode, I wasn't making, like, my words weren't even coming in my head. And it's because I am concentrating so hard all the time to not always be looking away. I feel like a lot of my attention goes on eye contact. I feel like I've always been that way. So it was, I suppose, when it's a way that you've always been, you don't think that it's off until, like, it was school then when teachers were screaming at me, look me in the eyes. And I was like, I can't look them in the eyes. That's when it really was like, okay, this could be something. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like what you're saying is it's making my brain tick because I feel like a lot of my attention, especially in new situations, not really with my friends as much, but in new situations can go on, make sure you're looking at them, make sure you're reacting this way, make sure you look like you're listening, you know what I mean? That sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's your masking. And that's what's so completely draining.
Yeah.
And it kind of comes back to the mirroring a bit because, you know, all humans want to be liked.
Yeah.
We all want to be able to connect with other humans.
Mm-hmm.
But if your brain is not primed in the way that you can flexibly move from one situation into another situation and just be social, then you're constantly guessing and second guessing yourself. Is this the way that I should behave? Oh, well, they did this, so maybe I should do that. They won't like if I do this.
Yeah.
And it's just this constant inner dialogue, this constant chatter that is very draining.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I have to go home after, you know, all my friends always laugh at me because every time we do anything, I just have to go home and lie in bed, like under my duvet for like 2 hours and just decompress. And it was only when I got my assessment that I realized like the neurotypical person, their brain isn't like constantly in this mode of thinking about absolutely everything all of the time. And I started realizing that like when I'm out, I'm thinking all the time about my body language, my eye contact, my what way. I'm actually thinking before a conversation happens, I'm thinking of ways that I can join the conversation. Or if I know something's going to happen, I'm like, okay, what questions can I ask? So it's so draining, really, really draining. And that's, I feel like that's why the social battery is so much lower, because it's actually that you're doing a lot more with your brain. You're thinking a lot more than you should have to be.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I'm wrong there. Maybe
you can. that's what my experience with me would have been. Yeah.
Yeah. I have my own personal question for you, because I find I follow a lot of autistic females online and would interact with a lot of them since I've got diagnosed. I love like looking at other girls and, there's always a pushback, I feel, with especially girls on social media that say they come out and they have autism. And I feel like a lot of the time it's to do with the fact that they have a social media account. It's like there's this like stereotype of like you can't be like outspoken on social media and you can't be opinionated and, you know, bubbly on social media and then also have autism. But for me, I find like my social media is my escape. It's like the best version of myself. I can record a video 15 times if I want. Mm. I don't have to put it up. It's not a face-to-face conversation. I don't know if, I don't know if how much you see online, but I feel like there's always quite a pattern. It's always like girls that do social media and then everyone's in the comments being like, you're lying, you're not autistic. And I wonder why that is, that people like think you can't do both. You know what I mean? Like,
because they're a really, really rigid idea of what autism is.
Yeah.
Which is problematic.
Yeah.
You know, and like I'm a really strong believer that everybody should be becoming more aware of the other.
Yeah.
So there's like traditionally we'll say, you know, social skills training. You know, social skills training?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would focus on giving a neurodivergent person the way that a neurotypical does it and expecting them to do a behavior in that particular way.
Mm-hmm.
My take on it is absolutely give a neurodivergent person that information so that they are now empowered to decide if they want to behave that way or if they don't. But simultaneously, there should be more useful information that's available for neurotypicals to help them understand more about the neurodivergent mm-hmm. presentation. Because there's these brush strokes of, oh, they all have social difficulties, or they all stem. You know, it's just too broad and they need more information. But one of the key ways of getting information is by you telling them.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you're walking into a new situation with Miriam O'Callaghan and saying, I mightn't be great on the eye contact now for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And you're giving yourself that license to be what you need to be.
Yeah.
And get your brain ready for the interaction that you're going into.
Yeah. That's actually, I feel like that can come in a lot of ways as well, because I feel like we were only saying this before in an episode, but anytime I'm nervous, even if I verbalize that I'm nervous, I immediately feel better. And it's like I'm giving myself the pass to be nervous. So I never thought of doing that when it comes to, you know, situations like eye contact. I should have went in. Miriam was so nice. She would have understood.
Yeah, but as you said yourself, you're so used to it. This is what you've always done since you had that experience in school and you started to realize it.
Yeah.
So it's just part and parcel of how you conduct yourself in your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
But again, when you get a diagnosis and you're like, okay, this is where we are.
Yeah.
And then working with a neurodivergent aware therapist is really good as well, because they should be giving you the license to be saying to people and to advocate for yourself, okay, actually, I don't do it that way. I do it this way.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm a wrong or, you know, I've got this thing and I'm sorry that I need, it's this is the way I do it.
Yeah. And that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, females mask more than men, or they mask differently than men.
Well, I mean, I suppose
not
traditionally
everyone.
The majority of males don't really mask.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Some females are such good maskers that they're completely unaware that they're actually autistic.
Yeah.
And so some, we'll say, older teens that might come into my clinic, as a couple come to mind, when they were given the diagnostic label and I asked them, you know, does this resonate with you? And they're like, no, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, they have great difficulty seeing it. And you know what? I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
No.
You know, we have to get along in life the best we can. And sometimes we tell ourselves lies.
Yeah.
Or we don't see things in certain ways. Like if you can't see things from another person's perspective, then the only way that can happen is by if the other person is giving you that information in a way that you can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always possible either.
Yeah.
You know, so there's lots of different kind of what we call compounding variables. There's lots of different things that are impacting your ability to understand it about yourself.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes I know sometimes, like some things I do, I'm like, okay, no, I'm definitely, like I have my diagnosis and still sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely neurodivergent. And then other times I'm like, no, I'm not. Like the psychologist is wrong. I'm lying to myself. I'm lying to everyone. I'm neurotypical. So I feel like, for me, I feel like a bit in the middle of that, because sometimes I'm like, no, I 100% see it. And then other times my brain just is like, no, you're not, and completely goes into denial. But I think a lot of that actually is people online. If you have people online every day telling you, no, you're lying, you're neurotypical, you're lying, you're looking for attention, it can really get in your head and you can be like, am I?
So do you read all your comments?
Yeah, I see them all. I don't reply and I don't reply and I delete and block, but we see them all. Like, they come up in our notifications. There's not millions of comments, so it's kind of hard to miss them. But yeah, I see them.
Yeah, I do... I'd like you to question over time how good that is for your mental health.
No, it's bad.
You know, like there are, if you have a team working with you, let them read them.
Yeah.
Now, this one was wonderful and this one was great.
Yeah.
And this one was fantastic. And don't worry about the rest of them.
Yeah, and get rid of them. Lauren's very good at that, actually. The podcast ones, but my own personal page. Now, I do have comment filters on. And like, I actually think that I have the word autism comment filtered, which is so bad. I shouldn't have to do that because that's what I am. But it's because when I said I was diagnosed, there was so much of that. And then it really, I felt so much acceptance. And I was angry as well when I got diagnosed, but that's a whole other story. I had a lot of anger, but also a lot of acceptance of myself after a little while. And then I felt like I was going backwards because of all these comments. I was like, oh, maybe I am looking for attention. Maybe I am a narcissist after all. And I was questioning everything. So yeah, you're definitely right. I shouldn't read them. They're not as bad now. I feel like since I've started the podcast, I feel like people have got more inside my brain and a little bit more. Maybe before, I would have been very high masking on social media, very like, don't ever show anything that people could take as being odd. I know it's not odd.
But
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas since my podcast, I feel like maybe I've opened up a lot more. We get comments saying that as well, don't we? That, yeah, so maybe.
But you're like, you're a hero, realistically, because young women and men, like, they need to see people standing forward and saying, yeah, I'm autistic and it's grand.
Yeah.
You know, they need to see that. They need to see you advocating for yourself.
Yeah.
And the other individuals that you said you're following on social media. Because only when they see somebody else modelling it can they have the confidence to do it themselves. Because you had years and years and years of social anxiety, worrying about different things, so you build up that wall,
yeah.
And so what you're deconstructing that wall now, yeah, very slowly, and do it slowly.
Yeah,
there's absolutely no rush. Never go faster than you want to go.
Yeah, yeah. Is it harder to diagnose neurodivergency in adults, do you think?
Well, I suppose you always need to have a good clinician.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what I mean by a good clinician actually is somebody who just has a lot of experience, because it's only through doing this all the time and seeing the different types of presentations and the different way the same thing manifests,
mm-hmm,
can you really have a good understanding about if a behaviour is part of a neurodivergency or not. The diagnostic criteria for a child is, there's a lot more detail in it. I know you mentioned the DSM-5 in your diagnostic podcast. Will I just talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so the DSM stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and we're on the fifth edition. So essentially what it is it's a book that clinicians use. If you go into a clinician's office in America or Canada or Ireland, we all use the same book with conditions in it and the different bits that make up that condition.
Mm.
That's the DSM. So, like, as I say, we're on the fifth edition now, but in the first edition back in the 60s, autism was diagnosed under schizophrenia.
No way.
Those characteristics.
No way. Yeah. That's
So the different editions come out over time because we're gathering more information about the presentations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the DSM. But for adults, that we use what's known as the NICE guidelines, and they are a much more abbreviated version,
mm-hmm,
of that, summarized version. So, but when you're interacting with somebody, like you're in the face-to-face interaction with them, a lot of the detail is there.
Yeah.
You know, you can see it there to the trained eye.
Yeah.
Like, I remember you mentioning in your own podcast as well about kind of that idea of, like, for all intents and purposes, you appear neurotypical.
Yeah.
Because you're giving off all the signals.
Yeah.
You're doing, you know, you look fantastic, you know, very much in line with other young women your age.
Yeah.
And so consequently, like, how would you be even be able to understand about what people your own age look and do?
Yeah.
So it's absolutely necessary that if you're going for a diagnosis, that you're 100% honest with your clinician.
Mm-hmm.
I know you mentioned as well that your dad came.
Yeah.
And so we do require that.
Yeah.
Because we do want to know what the presentation was like when the person was younger. So that can be tricky.
Yeah.
Because a parent may not be able to remember. They might have had five kids.
Yeah.
There might have been a very difficult or dysfunctional situation in the family home, and they may not be able, they mightn't have been able to be aware of the child as much as they wanted to be.
Yeah.
So there can be a lot of information that's lost there.
Yeah. I actually thought that when my dad had to come in, I was thinking for a lot of people that could be very difficult, because I'm very lucky that my dad is very clued in, and he mightn't have caught on to a lot of things when I was younger. But now looking back in retrospect, he does. Like when I got my report, when the psychologist sent the DSM-5, my dad was like, I can't believe there's been all these little things that just separately don't seem like much, but when you put them all together, it's like, oh my God, how have you even been living like this? So I remember thinking at the time how many people probably don't have, like, maybe their dad isn't as clued in, or maybe their parent is in denial as well. Would that ever be a thing? Because I feel like there'd be a lot of parents of people my age that are maybe a bit older and don't understand autism in the way that you would understand it, or that a younger person would understand it. So yeah, I can see why that would kind of put, not roadblocks, because obviously but I can see why that could be difficult for some people. I was very lucky. My dad is quite young and very, very clued in and very, very in tune. So he remembered. But looking back, he didn't, at the time he said, like, he didn't recognize these things at the time, but looking back he could recognize.
Some parents are in denial.
Yeah.
But what happens a lot is that the parents themselves are actually autistic.
Yeah.
So if you're asking a parent about a particular behavior, well, let's say for example eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or another question would be, does the individual display a typical range of facial expressions?
Mm-hmm.
If you're asking an autistic person that question, they're asking from an autistic perspective.
Okay. So
they go, oh, there's no problem with eye contact.
Oh, yeah.
No, there's no problem with facial expression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you can probably pick up on it from them, could you?
Generally, yes.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, that I would never communicate that back.
No,
But often people will say things.
Yeah.
Or there'll be kind of a joke that will be passed between two parents.
Yeah.
And that would, if that comes up, I'd often then I might make a comment on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you have any advice for someone who wants to support a family member that's recently been diagnosed or is struggling?
So I suppose if finances allow, linking in with a therapist to start, I think, is really, really key.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people are overwhelmingly happy about a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Other people don't always feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I would say would be advisable. To support the person in helping them understand that, look, we're going to be on this journey together. You don't need to do this alone. And to have conversations with them about specifically what they find challenging. There might be situations, for example, where they may benefit from some role play. Like if they're going into a new situation and they don't really know very much about it, or they're feeling nervous, let's role play it a bit so that you can get a sense of what your body's going to feel like when it's in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of information that's available about autism. You know, a lot of it's very clinical. You know, there's a lot of medical jargon that can be very difficult for people to actually understand what people are talking about. Do you find that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I actually think that young people are very lucky nowadays that they can access neuroaffirmative information through social media.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of, you know, there's some really, really good comedians as well that are out there.
Yeah.
Fern Brady. Have you come across Fern Brady?
No.
You love her.
I must look
her up. Check her out.
I'm going to write her down in my list that I don't take.
And then there's another Australian woman called Hannah Gatsby.
Okay.
She has a stand-up piece as well that focuses very much on her neurodivergence. But accessing information in this format, you know, it's lighthearted, it's easy to listen to,
yeah.
People can connect with it. Like, seeking information in alternative ways other than just going to do a training course, which is, can be very, very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes you need it kind of to hit home a little bit more as well.
Yeah, I wish I had, when I was younger, I wish that I was able to log on to social media and see people, particularly girls, because I'm a girl, speaking about how they're autistic. And I feel like maybe I would have understood myself years before I did if I had that. So I think it's amazing. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, people coming on talking about autism, looking for attention, when really it, I think it's actually really positive. Like what you're saying, there's going to be so many young people following these people, or if they're a comedian, watching their shows, whatever it may be, that might be able to connect the dots with themselves, whereas maybe they wouldn't have been before. Because I know with me, I feel like I definitely would have seen, I would have understood myself better if I had of had that access to just your average person, like a normal person, and not just, you know, as you said, when you go online, it's very clinical and hard to follow.
Yeah, yeah. And like, so in my age cohort, like, you know, yeah. The idea would have been, are you familiar with Rain Man?
No.
No, okay. So Rain Man, it was a movie that was out, I don't know, it was probably in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman was in it, and he was an individual who had autism, but he also would have had a severe learning difficulty.
Okay.
And a lot of people my age would have associated the label of autism directly with that presentation.
Okay.
So they would have had a massive, like, massive body response when autism is mentioned.
Yeah.
But it's just so much more broader now. And some young people that I've worked with, like, their parents have described actually getting a neurodivergent label is kind of like a cool thing in school.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I'm like, this is amazing.
This is great.
You know?
Yeah.
Just because it allows people to be free and to be their lovely, unique selves.
Yeah, it's definitely much more, like, I remember when I was in school, there was still probably a very, not, I don't want to say negative look, but it wasn't viewed the way it is now, like when I was in school. So it's good to hear that now there's kids that are like, no, this is cool, because it definitely wasn't that way when I was in school. And that's not that long ago. So we could be even more improved in 10 years time. It could be even better.
Sorry, there's two YouTubers as well.
Oh, yeah.
One of them is called Sam D. Sam. Have you come across her?
No. I'm like, how do I live on social media and I never
You know, I want to get the name of the social media people that you follow. Have you shared them with your listeners?
Yeah, one of them, she actually does some sort of workbook. It's brilliant. And she sent it to me. I think her name is Elle. But yeah, I would talk all the time about the neurodivergent people that I like to follow.
You're going to be up there now, Niamh. People are going to recommend this episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just in terms of like supporting people with a new diagnosis as well. Like, there are lots of really good books out there as well. Mm-hmm. And audiobooks for people who like don't particularly like reading. Personal stories.
Mm-hmm.
They are really, really key. Just like your own one.
Yeah.
You know, people can connect and identify with that. Whereas, you know, when they come to a clinician, again, it can be very, very valuable.
Yeah.
But it can be sterile.
Yeah.
And if you don't have access to them, please know that there is a lot of really good information out there. But if you're engaging, you're watching a video about something and something irks you, you don't like it, turn it off.
Yeah.
You don't need to continuously watch that. Neuroaffirmative is really, really important. Celebrating being neurodivergent, helping people understand. There's a book as well called Wired Differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that has, I think, like 30 different stories of different neurodivergent people around the world who've been very successful in what they do.
Yeah.
And it's because of their neurodivergency, not despite it.
I feel like for me, neurodivergency has really helped me with social media and creativity. I feel like my mind can work in ways that maybe other people's minds don't work. And also, I feel like it's made, I don't know if this is a bad thing or a good thing, but I feel like it's made me very resilient to other people's feelings and opinions. I feel like a lot of the things that have happened to me through social media, a lot of other people probably would have crumbled and deleted their accounts, whereas I always was quite resilient with it. Now, that's probably not a great thing. That probably comes back to being able to mask. But I have two actual, just top of my head, Holly and Diego. I'd be friendly with Holly. She's absolutely lovely. She's from the UK and she's autistic. She reminds me a lot of myself. And another one is Blind Boy. He actually has one of the most popular podcasts in Ireland, I think, Lauren, isn't it? It's one of the top podcasts, and he's autistic. So yeah, what you were saying, I feel like it can really help you be extra creative and think outside the box. I think people always focus on the negatives when there's actually a lot of positives as well.
Well, so in kind of the circles that I would go in, like socially,
yeah.
I find that the neurodivergent people, they're the creators.
Yeah.
They're the healers.
Yeah.
You know, they don't like status quo. Mm-hmm. So they have to go.
Beyond
it. No, they have to go beyond that. They yeah. have to colour outside the lines. So, like, it is the neurodivergent people who are the change makers.
Yeah.
Because they don't like the status quo. Mm-hmm. They say Bill Gates is autistic. But I think to look at the nugget of it is about, you know, change makers.
Yeah.
Not doing things in the same way that they've always been done.
Yeah. So, you're hosting a group programme for young females with autism. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So it is for 18 to 21 year old females with autism. So we're going to have a small group. There'll be a maximum of 8 participants. And it's in a beautiful place called The Sanctuary, which is, it's a meditative space, and they hold sound baths and different types of events of that kind of ilk. So primarily what we're going to be doing is psychoeducation. So I'll be helping people to understand more about what is autism, the different ways that it impacts on the body and the mind. It's important to kind of acknowledge the fact that autistic behaviours, they're just human behaviours. You know, they're all human behaviours, but the way that they're carried out or the way that they're understood is slightly different to neurotypicals. So a lot of emphasis on that. And then throughout that, then I'm going to be kind of introducing different types of strategies and techniques for example, understanding what is anxiety, and then a technique about how to manage anxiety on a day-to-day level, understanding more about the nervous system. And the sensory system, and becoming more in tune with the body, and figuring out, is this impacting my ability to go out and to be social? So, yeah, looking at strategy and looking at understanding more about the presentations. My idea is that I want to be giving people lots of different pieces of little pieces of information of different things, because we all process so differently that one person will be like, that really resonated with me. I like that bit there. And somebody else, it'll be something else. So it's not a one size fits all. Mm-hmm. It's quite a blanket introduction to lots of different things, and also a space for people to meet other young neurodivergent females. Mm-hmm. So it's a 6-week course. It's starting on the 4th of February, and it's from 6 until 7:45 on the Thursday evenings. So the format is going to be, I'm going to have about maybe 2 breaks in it. So there won't be like a lot of overwhelm. We'll have plenty of space for decompression, for moving. People will be encouraged to stim if they like to do that, to get up, move around. This isn't school.
Where can they find information on how to get involved with it?
So the best place to find information on it is on my website. So the name of my clinic is Sycamore Psychology, mm-hmm. which is tricky to spell. So I might just spell it for people.
Yeah.
So it's S-Y-C-A-M-O-R-E, psychology, P-S-Y-C-H-O-L, OGY. So www.sycamorepsychology.ie is the website. And then if people are interested in it, then they can get information there, but they can also contact us directly on admin@sycamorepsychology.ie.
Perfect. Amazing. I think that will be an amazing thing for young girls, especially to meet other young girls that are also neurodivergent.
The reason that I wanted to target this area was actually before Christmas, I worked with three young girls, 16, 17 year olds in a row, and it just struck me how completely lost they were. And I felt if we could just give them some good grounding information to help them understand and give them back a little bit more control in their lives.
That sounds amazing. I wish I was 18 to 21. Take a few years off. If you ever do an older one, you have to let me know, because I'd love to be involved. Okay, so guys, we have a dilemma, and me and Sarah are going to answer the dilemma together. So this listener wanted to stay anonymous. And the dilemma is, I have recently been diagnosed with autism and ADHD. And for my whole life, everybody calls me weird and unsocial and all that jazz. When I got the diagnosis, I was so happy to finally have reasoning instead of just being weird. I'm not sure why, but I've been nervous to talk to anyone around me about the diagnosis, as I made one of my childhood friends aware and she brushed me off by saying, "We all have that, sure." I'm just wondering, should I even bother disclosing it to people or just keep masking and relaxing in my personal time? How did you find telling people the closest to you about your diagnosis? And do you have any advice for me? Do you know what? I was really, really nervous to tell people. And I think because of the same reason as what you're describing, I think, I actually didn't believe myself. Like, I didn't even believe the psychologist for a little while. So I think it was a thing of, well, will other people believe me? And as I think as well, I have a lot of trauma that's happened in my life that just, I always keep things inside. So I think I found it really, really difficult. But I actually found that 99% of people were like, "Oh yeah, we know." And I was like, "What?" So I'm very lucky that I have a good understanding of autism within my family. I have family members with autism. And I think that really helped in my case. But I suppose the way I can bring it back to you is that when I said it online, I had a lot of people react the way that you're describing your childhood friend to have reacted. And I don't know, I just feel like you shouldn't ever allow one person to dictate that you're going to keep it made me sad when you said, "Will I keep masking and relaxing in my personal time?" Because clearly you're hyper aware that that's what you're doing. And nobody should have to do that, and nobody should be made to feel like that. Now, I actually have, and I'd be really happy for this listener if she wants to message me personally. When I got my diagnosis, I got given basically a little booklet to give to everybody that I wanted to tell. And I actually can't remember exactly what was in it. But like, the first thing was like, "Hi, I have autism." Like, and it was explaining to them through this booklet of my diagnosis and the way I am. And I found that really, really, really good. I sent that to members of my family and I showed it to my boyfriend. And I found that a really good way to kind of be an icebreaker. So yeah, that's, I feel like I don't know how to answer this question really, because I found when I said to a lot of my family, they were kind of very understanding, and maybe a lot of them maybe thought that themselves anyway, or at least thought there was something, you know what I mean? So maybe Sarah will be better to jump in here and give you some advice.
I think you gave a great answer, Niamh, actually. You know, it's really helpful to have something like that, like a booklet, because it can be very difficult to articulate and find the words to communicate to other people. And it's so unfortunate that this is what this listener's experience has been. Like, if this was the first person that she chose, and I presume she felt like she could trust this person.
Mm-hmm.
But 100% no, she should not continue masking and keep it to herself. She obviously had a reason for going to get the diagnosis in the first place, and she needs to honour that in herself. I think something that might be useful, we've kind of touched on it already, would be becoming aware of the areas that she does find challenging and writing them out. Stock sentences are something that I think are really, really good, so that when you're in a particular situation, somebody asks you a particular question or there's something you want to communicate, you have already, you've already thought about it, you've already formulated what that sentence looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And you've mentioned the notes section in your phone, and I said it's my favourite part of the phone, because that's where you can put all these different types of pieces of information, things to remind yourself, stock sentences that you need to say. For example, everyone has a touch of autism. So the answer that I always give to that is, no, that's not accurate. Autistic behaviours are human behaviours, but they're different. People respond differently and use social information in a different way. When you're able to give somebody some kind of reasoning, or kind of what we call a qualitative reason for this, it helps their journey of understanding you. But just the standalone, I'm autistic, is not really enough for people, because everyone's a view of it is so different.
Mm-hmm. I feel like as well, you're always going to have like one or two people that are kind of, oh, well, we all have that, or maybe brush it off. But you should never let a minority dictate. Like, as Sarah said, you made the decision to get the diagnosis, which obviously means that you want some sort of, I don't know what the word is, like not improvement, but you want
clarity.
Clarity, exactly. So you should never allow the words of one person to take that away from you, or allow the words of one person to take the confidence away from you. Because honestly, I think you'll find that people can be, especially family, especially friends, I think would be, are most of the time, are a lot more understanding than we actually give them credit for. So yeah, I think it's really sad, and I'm really sorry to hear that that person reacted in that way. But I also think that maybe have a conversation with that person and be like, okay, this made me uncomfortable for this reason. And I know I really struggle to do that, okay? I can't do that 90% of the time. But maybe if this person understood the impact of like the words like that, they'd be more mindful if somebody else ever came like that in the future.
But just like you were talking about, something that you really like about social media, yeah, is the fact that you can essentially, you can do dry runs.
Mm.
You can practice what you want to say.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of autistic people communicate much better in the written form.
Yeah.
So writing down what she'd like to say to this person.
Yeah.
And or making a video,
yeah,
and say, send it in the video. Because, you know, again, I don't know if you find this, but, you know, autistic people can be quite slow at processing.
Yeah.
So it just takes a wee while to formulate your answers.
Yeah.
And often other people, they'll interject really quickly and you don't have, yeah, a chance to finish your sentence. So being able to communicate it in a format that you're not getting interrupted in.
Yeah.
Because even saying to people, actually, do you mind giving me a minute to finish my sentence? Sometimes that can even be seen as being aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to learn to advocate for yourself, yeah, and do it slowly.
Yeah.
It's all about moving slowly. But as long as you're moving,
that's
in a forward direction, that's what's important. If you're standing still, that's not good. But it doesn't matter how slowly you're moving, as long as you're moving forward.
As long as you're moving, yeah. Yeah, I think that's great advice. And as I said, if this person wants to reach out to me privately, I can send you the little booklet thing that I got when I got diagnosed. And that really gave me confidence as well, because it was like, I don't have to explain all of this. And it's done for me and it's here. And anybody that I felt I was nervous to say it to, like, I was even, my boyfriend knows me more than anything. And he was the first person to be like, yeah, I think you definitely are. But even saying it to him when I really was diagnosed, I felt like this awkwardness and this, like, I don't know, maybe because it's something that you're not, you don't even understand yourself yet. So I found the booklet really, really helpful, and I can send that to you no problem if you want to reach out privately. Okay, Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. I feel like this episode is going to be so helpful for so many people. One of the biggest questions I get since I came out with my diagnosis is questions surrounding autism, and people especially teenage girls, actually, a lot questioning themselves. And I think I could be. And so I feel like this is going to be a really, really good episode for people to listen to and get a better understanding and learn a bit more about autism. And all of the information for Sarah's group is going to be linked in the bio of this podcast. So if anybody is interested, they can pop over and have a look. Thank you so much, Sarah. And we are so grateful that you came in and you gave us a couple of hours of your day today to educate us. I feel like you've educated me even. So thank you.
I really, really appreciate the time and having me here. And it's been really enjoyable. I'm all about getting good, clear information out to people and just making the world a little bit more of a connected space for everybody, safe space for everybody.
Thank you so much. Right, guys, that is officially the end of our episode. And if you want to follow us on Instagram so you can get involved in episodes, guys, please do, because we have so many listeners that do not follow us on Instagram, okay? And I'm actually taking personal offense to it. I tell you this every single week. It's at @unscriptedgoloud on Instagram. Okay, guys, thank you. Bye. Love you.
Unscripted with Niamh O'Connor, a Go Loud original podcast.